Are children and adolescents being silenced and their growth stunted in the age of quick diagnosis and over-medication? In her new book, The Silenced Child, Dr. Claudia Gold, who practices behavioral pediatrics in the Berkshires, shows the tremendous power of listening in parent-child and doctor-patient relationships. Through vivid stories, perceptive insights, and new research, she shows the way children grow from these relationships and how being heard actually changes their brains. The name of the new book, again, is The Silenced Child, From Labels, Medications, and Quick-Fix Solutions to Listening, Growth, and Lifelong Resilience. It is a great pleasure to welcome Dr. Claudia Gold to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Very nice to have you here once again. Let us talk about the basic of what silences a child.
Well, when we are quick to name something that they are struggling with as indicative of something wrong with them, rather than listening to the meaning of their behavior, children communicate through their behavior from earliest infancy. And when we listen to what that behavior means, then we understand how to help them, rather than just naming it as a problem and then eliminating it.
When we say naming it, is that another word for diagnosis?
Yes.
Give us a scenario of how that happens very often.
Well, so let's say a child is looking out the window in the classroom and moving around a lot and kind of fits the criteria for a diagnosis of ADHD. So let's say a teacher in a busy classroom has this kid moving around and so sends the family to the pediatrician, who then does a checklist, and the child gets a label of ADHD and increasingly either treated with behavior modification or increasingly medication. However, and this has happened to me many, many, many times, let's say we take an hour and we sit with that family and we unwrap the full complexity of the situation. And I have a number of cases like this in my book. So one thing that's very common that I've gotten a growing appreciation of as a pediatrician is sensory processing challenges, that kids who are extremely sensitive to lights and sounds and just have a very sort of different sensory experience, that there are certain situations that are more challenging for them. And if you can kind of attend to that and help them with that in creative ways, that can help them to manage themselves in a situation like the classroom. Other such things that may be going on are there is stress in the home, in the form of family marital conflict, or even, you know, more significant things, domestic violence, and kids' hyperactivity is an expression of a reaction to stress. So those are kind of two examples of the complexity to the story that's behind the child's behavior.
So you start off the book by talking about the importance of listening, which helps eradicate much of what you just talked about. I want to talk about listening, and I want to get into that a little bit deeper. But what is it, do you think, that keeps us from doing that in the first place?
From listening.
Yes. Because it seems like a very natural
it
response.
It does seem to make sense. Well, that's why, and I do explain in the book, it's really a complex convergence of cultural forces. So, for example, in a pediatrician's practice, due to sort of the complexity of the healthcare system and the health insurance industry, pediatricians are forced to see more and more patients in less and less time, so that it's hard to take aside an hour, even though we know from the research that we investing in that hour saves money in the long term. In the short term, primary care doctors are under a lot of pressure to see patients in a short amount of time. And we really need to change that, because in my practice, I started doing that. I started just taking an hour for a visit when a parent was stressed. And it doesn't have to be at the time of the well visit. You can schedule it as a follow-up. But another thing I talk about in the book is that the time is really critical, because parents feel stressed and they feel not safe, really, talking about some of these things. So the time is really critical. But certainly in the primary care setting, time does not actually have a monetary value, and that's a problem. So then you have another layer, which is the sort of the pharmaceutical industry, and the fact that it's as a society, we condone treating these problems just with medication. So that kind of creates its own problem, because the pill can then replace the person who does the listening, and it's more cost effective. So it creates this sort of downward spiral where listening is less and less valued, both culturally and monetarily.
You say in the book that so often parents will come in and say, "What's wrong with my child?" And mm-hmm. you try to reframe that.
Mm-hmm.
How so?
Well, this also comes out of decades of research in developmental psychology, that when we approach a child from a stance of curiosity, not wondering what's wrong with them, but trying to make sense of it, then we can, when we have the opportunity to take the time to think about it, we can see why the child is behaving that way rather than labeling it as something wrong with them. Those things I spoke to you about at the beginning are certainly common examples. Often we kind of uncover a story that makes sense of the behavior. So I'm trying to open up a space for curiosity. You know, we have this kind of quick fix culture, and parents feel under so much pressure to know the answer. And that comes from a lot of places. But I want to help them to feel the courage, really, to take the time to make sense of why their child is behaving that way, and give their child an opportunity to kind of, in a sense, grow into themselves in a healthy way. But that doesn't mean not getting help. And I think that that's an important distinction. Parents often say to me, but you need a label to get services, which is true, actually. But I don't think that's good, because it's nice if we can help a family and give them time to be heard without having to jump to label their child as having something wrong with them.
You talk about, as it does in the subtitle of the book, of labels, medications, and quick fix solutions. There may very well be a solution that is a quick fix, but mm-hmm. you still want to come to it through time and diagnosis.
Yeah. Well, I think that it is a relatively quick fix, because, you know, when I sit with a family of a young child, it's maybe an hour or two of devoted time we can really come to make sense of things. And the making sense of things becomes the solution. The listening itself is the treatment. So I think the problem with the quick fix is the need to eliminate the problem right away, rather than tolerating the discomfort of struggling. I mean, I think that struggling is a normal part of existence, and working and even suffering. In the book, I reference Buddhism a lot, kind of the idea of ordinary suffering, that we need to allow ourselves and our children to kind of work through difficult things rather than just making them go away right away.
Dr. Claudia Gold is our guest. The name of the new book is The Silenced Child. It is published by DeCapo. When you think of parents coming to you, and you were saying that the timing is very important, and there are all kinds of pressures that they're put under, and some of those pressures are what? Because I assume, obviously, it's other children. It's also mm-hmm. the school environment, right?
Yes. And the school environment, I speak to quite a bit in the book,
right,
is critical, because classes are larger and larger sizes. There's more structured curriculum. There's less opportunity for free play. And particularly as we, you know, head into this, what is actually a good thing, the idea of preschool for all. But if we don't have teachers who are adequately trained and supported in listening to children and helping children who are struggling with emotional regulation, then teachers are, you know, understandably, their top priority is to keep their classrooms safe. So without the kind of support that really is needed for the teachers, it's understandable that there's a push to label and medicate.
You do make the point, and I don't want to give the impression in our conversation, but you make the point in the book that we aren't just talking about school-age kids. This can mm-hmm. go babies that you're listening
yes.
to as well.
Yes, and that's my favorite chapter of the book, is actually
yeah.
listening to babies, because I think people aren't really aware of really how much we can do. I mean, that involves such far-reaching things as paid parental leave, kind of not only screening for postpartum depression, but really thinking of postpartum depression as kind of an umbrella term for the challenges of the transition to parenthood and really creating a space in our culture that holds parents through that experience and values parents. I think our culture, our country is uniquely lacking in a culture of postpartum care. And when we can protect time for parents in that experience, then we protect babies. I mean, babies, the human infant is uniquely helpless in the first weeks and months of life. And I think we have this kind of expectation of this rapid return to pre-pregnancy functioning, and parents struggle with social isolation. And we really need to support parents of young children. I mean, I do these wonderful mother baby groups and father baby groups, which are just fantastic. And they really help families set on a healthy course from the very beginning.
And do you consider the parent and parents to be your patients as well?
Yes, I think of the family as okay. being my client, and it's actually the way it's thought of in this new field of infant mental health. It's the relationship, so that when I see a family that's struggling, I think the problem is not either in the parent or in the child, but in the relationship. So where each experience meets the other. And when I work with a parent and a child together, we sit on the floor and we see kind of the way the baby may be particularly hard to settle. Like that's a quality that's in the baby. And then we see the mother might be feeling that somehow that's her fault, or she may have struggled in her own childhood. And so we can kind of tease apart what are the things that belong to the parent and what are the things that belong to the child, and how do they affect each other. And so I might see a family where they're in a sort of unhelpful pattern of interaction, where each is sort of escalating the other's distress. And then we sit on the floor, and I think of it as kind of a dance. We learn a new dance. They're sort of in a dance where they're stepping on each other's toes. And when we have this nice, quiet space to listen, we can help them to have a more healthy and sort of loving kind of dance with each other.
I had, growing up, I had a wonderful pediatrician. And and one of those people that I still stay in touch with, because wow. it was just such an important person in my life. That is rare now, isn't it? I mean, to find even someone like yourself, because so many people go into the system in a primary care setting or an urgent care setting, and they'll go in and somebody comes in to see them, to see their child, and then that doctor is off to the next examination room where it may be a 78-year-old with an inner ear issue. Mm-hmm. So there isn't quite that time to investigate what you are talking mm-hmm. about that happens in pediatrics.
Yeah, I think that there are a lot of changes in the field that are moving in the opposite direction. And I think that, yes, big practices, where you're not necessarily going to see the same doctor every time with your child. So that's the kinds of things I think we need to change. I mean, I hope that this is sort of like an urgent call to action, that we cannot give this up, because it's got significant consequences if we stop protecting time to listen to families. And so I think we need to change that system of care in pediatrics so pediatricians who are interested and want to can take that time. The other thing I want to say is, which I do talk about in the book also, is that there's a whole field of infant mental health, which doesn't mean babies lying on the couch, but it means, you know, people who are trained in the kinds of treatments that I talk about. And I think placing someone like that in a primary care setting where a pediatrician can say, oh, this mom and baby are really struggling, there's this, we refer to it as the nice lady or man down the hall model, you know, so that you can take that family right then and there in the practice and have someone who's actually more highly trained to work in this area, to see them right away. And that would be really an ideal situation.
Let me bring this down to the most basic level. If I'm a parent and I'm having problems with my child mm-hmm. and I call your office, what mm-hmm. do I say to get an appointment with you? Meaning, mm-hmm. what does it take for that triage that takes mm-hmm. place in the phone call? Mm-hmm. Because some of these problems are, well, my kid is acting up, my kid is having problems, mm-hmm. my kid is doing this, my kid is doing that. To be able to put that into that box mm-hmm. of saying, even so many of appointments are even made online now, mm-hmm. What is the trouble mm-hmm. to get the attention of the people who will get me in to see the person who can help me with that issue?
Well, that's a difficult problem because, I mean, in my practice, well, I have a very specialized practice. So,
right.
So people are referred to me.
Absolutely.
So it's a different situation. But in the ideal world, and this is what I think we need to work towards, you should be able to make an appointment saying not having to make it be in a box. So, but right now I've had this experience where a parent just wants to figure out why their child is struggling and they have to make the appointment for an ADHD evaluation. So to be honest with you, there really is no good answer to that question. I think my hope with the book is to give parents courage to advocate for their children and say, I just want to talk about the problem. I just want to tell you what's going on. I don't want you to have to put me in a box right away, because that is the way our culture works now, sadly. So parents really have to be advocates for their kids.
Let me ask about one of the phrases that you use, and it's even in the subtitle of the book, and that is lifelong resilience.
Mm-hmm.
What is that, and is that the gold standard? Is that what we're trying to achieve?
Well, resilience is a very popular word these days, and I think there are different understandings of what it means, but some people think of it as something you attain in the face of some major trauma. But research of Ed Tronick and kind of echoes ideas of Winnicott and the idea of the good enough mother, which is that you develop resilience, and this is evidence bears this out, not by overcoming some major horrible thing, but by surviving the little things that happen throughout life, throughout as growing up, and then you know, it starts out, let's say you're an infant and your mom goes to answer the doorbell and you are in the middle of breastfeeding. And this is upsetting to a 1-week-old infant. But they survive that disruption and the mother comes back and speaks soothingly to the baby. And then you survive these disruptions by having a caregiver who's present with you and able to be flexible. And that's how you develop resilience, is in the day-to-day kind of mismatches and repair that go on. And then as you get older, these mismatches and repair get bigger. You know, I have early adult children, young adult children, and I know that when it's hard to kind of hold them through difficult times, but you see that when you resist the temptation to say, well, this is wrong with you, but rather stay with them and can handle letting them struggle a little bit, then that's how they develop resilience. And even when you screw up as a parent, which you do, which all parents screw up, and then you say, well, you know, that didn't go well, and I'm sorry. That's another way that kids develop resilience.
I thought of this a lot as I was reading the book, and I guess that is, we don't have a great, without over-editorializing on my part, it doesn't seem like we have a great mental health system that can completely, you know, deal with the issues that we have.
Mm-hmm.
So you bring that to a pediatric level and to a child's level of looking at those mental issues, where a lot, we can extrapolate that a lot of what we see in adolescence and early adulthood could have been tagged at birth or early in the child's development.
Mm-hmm.
So with just taking one speck of the mental health system and looking at it and given your expertise in this subject of mental health, what can we do to better that, to improve that system so there is more time given to the mental health of the child?
Well, I think the field of infant mental health gives us the answer to that. I mean, once we have the time, so once you have the ability to sit with the family and
right.
listen, you have a developmental frame so that you don't just ask what's going on today and say, well, these are your symptoms, but you actually make sense of where these things came from, starting from infancy. So even if you're not treating the actual infant, if you understand that problems don't come out of nowhere, that having that kind of developmental perspective and being able to listen to what was the person, if you have the parent there, what was the infancy like and what were the issues that went on, and kind of see how you got where you are, that also is part of the treatment. The other is, as I said, relational. So rather than seeing a problem as residing just in that person who's sitting in front of you, to understand that you make sense of an individual's problems based on their historical and relational context. And the last thing, which is also a sort of foundation of infant mental health and actually was the subject of my first book, is to be curious about meaning, to have being able to be reflective and find out motivations and intention of behavior is a uniquely human capacity. And it's really central to our evolutionary success. So in the mental health field, to emphasize the search for meaning over the need to name and eliminate problems.
The name of the book is The Silenced Child. So the best case scenario, the opposite of this, would be what?
The listened to child and family.
And understood.
And understood, yes, yes.
And that's the ultimate goal and aim.
Yes.
It's a fascinating book. It is entitled The Silenced Child, From Labels, Medications, and Quick Fix Solutions to Listening, Growth, and Lifelong Resilience. Dr. Claudia Gold is the author. The book is published by DaCapo. Thank you so much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you back on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book is The Silenced Child, published by DaCapo. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.